Thursday, June 6th. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry?
Yes.
Cherry Gregg?
Yes. Avi Wolfman Arendt.
It was revealed in federal court yesterday that U.S. Senator Bob Menendez eats at the same steakhouse in Washington, D.C. 250 times a year. Can you believe that?
Wow.
How many times could you eat at the same restaurant in a given year before you got sick of it? I mean, it's way below 250 for me.
Well, I mean, if you call your kitchen a restaurant, I eat there every single day.
I don't, but okay. Good answer. Good deflection. I think I could get to 50 before I...
In a year.
I think I could get to 50. I think I could.
Well, some people just like what they like. You know, some people go to Wawa every day and get the same exact...
I will say going to Wawa, like I go to the same breakfast spot every single Wednesday, Taco Heart in South Philly, and I get the same order. I think that's very different than sitting down at a restaurant 250 times a year.
But it's a steak spot? What is it?
It's a steakhouse.
Steakhouse. Well,
you know who's not having steak? Vegans.
Oh, yeah. Good transition.
And we're going to talk about veganism today in the back half of the show, the vegan trends and what's available beyond what used to be available.
Yeah.
Beyond being an operative word there, beyond meat.
Beyond meats.
So we're going to talk about veganism back half of the show today. Mm-hmm. In this segment, we're going to talk with a developer who is proposing to build a skyscraper in West Philadelphia devoted exclusively to drug rehabilitation. Pretty interesting proposal.
Yeah.
Never heard of anything quite like it. So that's the end of this segment. And then in between, we're going to talk with Inquirer reporter Ellie Rushing. She did a really fantastic story, a deep dive into what it takes for a young person to come forward and testify against people who have committed murders in the city of Philadelphia. And you think, boy, that takes a lot of courage. Mm-hmm. But that's just a blanket statement. When you actually get into the details of what it takes, it goes beyond that word courage. I mean, it takes a lot of coordination.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it takes
courage. It takes money.
It takes money.
Yeah.
I mean, so it gives you a sense of why it is so hard to prosecute these cases. Because when you see what it takes for one person to come forward, you realize that's hard to repeat over and over and over again. So it's a great story. I'm excited to talk with her about it.
I am too. I covered criminal justice for a long time in the city, and so many people just refused to come forward. But this young person was so courageous, and it gave closure to so many families.
Yeah.
It also got some shooters off the street that were causing
repeat offenders.
So the city has always said they're a small group of people doing a lot of the shooting. So yeah, we'll talk about that. I'm looking forward to that. Also, if you want to have questions about veganism, if you are on the fence, if you're considering it, give us a call, get your questions in. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. So I had mentioned the day. Today is June 6th.
Mm-hmm.
It's the 80th anniversary of D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
It's where more than 150,000 Allied troops invaded France to drive out the Nazis during World War II. And one forgotten hero is forgotten no more, Avi. Waverly Woodson, an Overbrook High School grad and Philly native, he was honored this week with the Distinguished Service Cross. It's the nation's second highest military honor. Now, I've done a story on this, on Waverly Woodson several years ago for the 75th anniversary. He was in the Army's 320th Balloon Barrage Battalion. That was the only African-American unit of soldiers that was there on D-Day. They provided critical protection to Allied soldiers as they stormed the beaches that day. He was then 21 years old. He was a medic. And despite his own injuries, he saved dozens and some say up to 200 lives that day. He was nominated for the Medal of Honor during the war, but because of racism that existed at the time, no black soldiers were given the honor at that time. And then in 1973, a fire destroyed all records of his service. So
the proof that he had done what he had done.
And a memo of the nomination was later found by a journalist, which then began a 30-plus year push to get Woodson this Medal of Honor. And I want to play a clip of Stephen G. Woodson, the son of the late Waverly Woodson, reading some of his father's congressional testimony back in the 1990s. He also reflects on it. It was part of the National Geographic's The Color of Victory series, which aired last year. Take a listen.
My father, Waverly Woodson, was a witness to D-Day. Was the most emotional and dangerous day of my life. The assault units waited impatiently to begin their mission. This day, D-Day prejudices took a back seat. Afterwards, it was a different story. To this day, the black soldiers were never given credit for their outstanding services beyond the call of duty. I never got the gravity out of it that I've gotten right now.
Now, so many of those forgotten soldiers have been since honored, Avi, and with Waverly Woodson, now at least he doesn't have the highest honor, the Medal of Honor, but the Service Cross, the second highest honor, is something that I think is still really, really special.
Waverly Woodson.
Yes.
A Philadelphia hero. We'll just say his name again, Waverly Woodson.
And by the way, he's featured in Erased, World War II's Heroes of Color. It's a four-part docu-series produced by actor Idris Elba. You can check it out on Hulu if you're interested in seeing his story. It's going to be acted out there. So, yeah.
Thanks for shining the light on
that.
Thank
you.
Thanks, Cherry. If you're listening to this program right now and you're in your car in the state of Pennsylvania and you also happen to be doing anything with your cell phone, put it down because you're breaking the law, folks.
Ooh.
Governor Josh Shapiro has signed a bill into law that will help police enforce traffic stops for using your cell phone while driving. The only permissible use is hands-free use. And yes, now they can pull you over if they see you texting, if they see you holding your phone. All that stuff you know you're not supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, if a police officer sees you doing it, she or he can pull you over.
Yeah, and the fine, $50. So, yeah.
You say that like it's a lot.
No. But, I mean, people do it so often.
Right.
That, I mean, you could get tapped a lot.
I'm not saying it's not, but you seemed impressed by the...
Yeah, $50 fine. Yeah,
and
it's nothing. There is a grace period of a year.
Yeah.
So you do have some time to adjust. But, yeah, you could get pulled over now. So.
Lots of states have these laws.
Mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania's is now a lot easier to enforce,
yep.
I think, is the upshot here.
That is the upshot. So there is a mural in South Philly that depicts Eagles fans climbing poles. It's one of our favorite traditions whenever mm-hmm. our major sports team wins.
We climb up the poles.
We yeah. climb up the poles.
Even
know,
though they're greased.
They're greased, but they still, yeah, we still do it. And there is now an exact match for an image taken by WHYY reporter Corey Sharber, apparently, that the mural is the picture. Explain this,
because
Avi told me about this story, so explain this.
Here's what happened. There is a mural in South Philadelphia that adorns the side of a bank. Lovely mural, and it's sort of a tribute to South Philadelphia culture. And it's got all sorts of images on it, but one of them is a fan climbing a light pole with a very distinctive sort of grip of the pole. And
the
fan.
With an Eagles jersey on?
With an Eagles jersey on. It's a nice little image. Our own Corey Sharper took a photograph and published a photograph on WHYY's website
mm-hmm.
that is this exact same image.
Yeah.
It is very clearly
yeah.
a replica of a photo that Corey took, which just made me think, like, is that okay? Like, lots of murals around Philly
mm-hmm.
are images, they're painted images that do look like photographs that I would imagine are based on originally on photographs. This mural didn't credit Corey, didn't acknowledge Corey. And I don't know how common that is, how legal that is, but even beyond that, how ethical that is.
Yeah.
Because it's very clearly his photograph.
No, it's definitely clearly and strongly inspired by his photograph. And I would say that at the very least, they should have credited Corey at the bottom. It should have said some little credits on there.
They didn't even tell him. By the way, this mural has been up for months.
Yeah.
And no one here even knew about
mm-hmm.
it.
I'm just throwing out, I teach a journalism law class. This falls under copyright law. And the argument that they would probably make is that this is fair use.
Mm-hmm.
That, they're not selling images of this. This is on the wall. This is educational. Kids were involved. And so, but somebody was paid to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So some money was involved.
The money is one thing.
But ethics, it does raise red flags when it comes to ethics, because should they have at least given him credit? Should they have called and asked for permission?
Yeah.
Could they have done it? He's easy to find because clearly he's on Twitter.
Yeah, I give credit to Corey. It's a great picture.
It is.
It's a really great action shot.
And if I was Corey, I'd be popping my collar like my photo is on a wall now. But I would like my little name at the bottom. And that's something we could ask.
Just a name. You know, I don't know. Just putting it out there. Mm-hmm. We do have some news on the Philadelphia budget. It seems like Mayor Sherelle Parker is going to get approval from City Council for her budget. And in it, there is a proposal for a $100 million drug and wellness center in Northeast Philadelphia, right near the prison complex up on State Road. That was a big sticking point. That's something the mayor really pushed for and wanted, this comprehensive drug treatment facility up in Northeast Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And now it looks like it probably will happen.
And she kind of needed it to happen, especially after she cracked down on Kensington's open air drug market. And so it kind of brings us to the next story, our newsmaker for this segment. There's another drug and alcohol rehabilitation facility being proposed in Philly. And we read about it in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It's an article by Jake Bloomgart. This one is planned for University City. It's abutting a Penn student housing building that was formerly the International House. The real estate firm CSC, which operates in Mexico and the U.S., has plans to build a 40-plus story tower with 150 to 250 beds for substance use disorders.
And that would make it one of the largest addiction treatment centers in the country. Joining us to tell us more about this proposal, what hurdles remain, and the community's response is Sal Smecky, managing partner for CSC, which is developing this project. Sal, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And so, Sal, I wanted to start the conversation about this proposal, this towering rehab facility. Can you try to describe your vision for us?
Sure. Well, we're very data oriented. We go by the numbers. So every project that we go through, we want to make sure that the numbers pencil out. You can build the biggest building or the biggest hotel in the world. If there's no demand for it, there's no point for it. So a just quick back of the envelope so that everybody understands in very simple terms about the drug addiction that is going on in Philadelphia, and then I can jump into the project very simply. So in the United States, we have an approximate amount of people of about 330 million people, okay? In Philly, we have 1.6 million people. So the people in Philadelphia represent one half of 1% of the population in the United States. So half of a percent. In the United States, there's 86,000 people that die from overdose every single year, 86,000. So if you do the math, you say, okay, so 86,000, we represent a half of a percent, so we should have about 400 deaths every year in Philadelphia. Guess how many deaths are overdosed in Philadelphia every single year? We would estimate it would be 400, right? Well, the number is 50 to 100 deaths a year in Philadelphia, which is 13 times the national average. So that goes to show you that even though with the mayor's program, building 600 beds to cater the people is not enough for the 5,200 deaths that we have every single year in Philadelphia, which means that you have 14 people dying every single day in Philadelphia from overdose. So the people that are overdosed doesn't mean that they're not doing drugs. Those are the people that really got to the bottom of the barrel. But what about the thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that continue to do shots either in Kensington or all these other areas? So the point that I'm making here is that the demand for a drug and rehabilitation center, even as big as we build it, is not enough to be able to cover that dent.
Well, Sal, just real quick, I think the number of overdose deaths is around 1,400 in Philly, but it is still disproportional to your point. So why build this type of facility to solve that problem? Because we don't typically see rehab centers of this size, of this scale. It's not usually all centralized in this way. And I think a lot of people would just be curious why this type of project to solve the big problem that you're talking about.
Yeah, so we are lovers of the city of Philadelphia. We're very blessed on the projects that we've done there before. We believe that the demand is there. Why is it so large? Because we believe that there is an immense amount of demand for that product, and that's why we're doing it so large. We're trying to address not only drug and abuse, but also alcohol abuse. Mm-hmm. So it will be some sort of like the largest drug abuse center in the Northeast. So we're expecting, if we can be filled with the people from Philadelphia, great. But if there's going to be more people coming either from New Jersey or from Wilmington or from Delaware, I mean, this should be the hub or the Mayo Clinic of drug rehabilitation center in the Northeast.
Got to ask you, why University City? I know you guys own the property there, but of all the different neighborhoods we have, why University City for this hub?
It's a great question. So a lot of the council women or council men of different areas do not want to approve anything but what's already there. We were lucky enough to have a councilwoman which is open-minded and wants the best for the city of Philadelphia and wants diversity. And that's why in the site that we own in University City, the councilwoman initially is giving us the green light or not opposing to investigating more and doing that. So that's really why. That's number one. And number two is because in University City, there's not a lot of permanent residents. Most of the people that are there are either students that are there for 6 months or a year. So there's not really a lot of permanent residents that will affect them in a big way. In other areas of Philly, either it's family areas or more all-year-round oriented, but here it's not the case.
Yeah.
And so
that's why there's less opposition for that.
So you're expecting less community pushback given the location, is what you're saying.
That's one. Two is because we have the rights to, as of right to build. Three is because we have a positive reaction from the council people.
It.
So that's, I guess that's where it goes.
And the Inquirer said that you already have the financing pretty much lined up for this project and that you expect to break ground this year. Is that true? You've kind of got your ducks already in a row here?
Yeah, we've been working on this project for over 2.5 years. So it's not something that we just woke up yesterday to figure this out. The financing market for a project like this only works when the demand is so grand and so large. We have a great experience building, and we have very good relationships with our lenders. And this is a product that will be a massive success, not only for the product itself, but also for the city of Philadelphia. We'll be able to clean up the entire city within one location.
Got to ask you, CSC seems to work in an area where you work to create more affordable housing for young renters. And it doesn't seem like you've been in the space of rehabilitation facility. Why step out of your usual expertise to do this project?
Yeah, so the website of CSC doesn't describe everything that we've done. I mean, we are the largest landlords in Mexico. We own over 10,000 properties across 32 states. Just to give you a little flavor, in the United States, the last project we did was a church and a school in Harlem, in which we were able to convert a church and a school into a charter school for needed children. And right now it has 750 students, K-12, in 129th and Harlem. So we really go where the community needs help. So be it a rehabilitation center, be it a school, a church, be it a affordable housing component. So in any kind of where there is a demand, that's where we jump in.
So this would be your first, though, rehabilitation center.
We have done prior medical centers, drug rehabilitation center. We are partnering with a large operator, which I cannot disclose who that is, that will be operating this asset, but we will be building it on their behalf.
Well, that is Sal Smecky, managing partner of CSC Real Estate. They are involved in this proposal to build a skyscraper in West Philadelphia exclusively dedicated to drug rehabilitation. Sal Smecky, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
And coming up, the story of a young man who helped police solve multiple homicides. Stick with us. Lots to come on Studio 2. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. As we know all too well, Gun violence claims the lives of hundreds of Philadelphians every year, and in many cases, police cannot identify the perpetrators, in part because of the code of silence. This is a system deeply ingrained in the city's gun crisis. Witnesses do not come forward. They do not give information on shooters to law enforcement. And in many cases, it's because they themselves are threatened with violent retaliation.
Gangs in the city have subjected crime witnesses to such deadly intimidation that they've needed police protection. And even that has not been enough to stop it. But one young man broke the code, bringing down several members of a notorious West Philly gang. In a new story, Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Ellie Rushing writes about this brave young man, what it took for him to shatter the code of silence, and why it's so difficult for witnesses to do that. Ellie Rushing joins us now to tell that story. Ellie, welcome to Studio 2.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, reading this story, you know, I knew going into it, Ellie, that a lot of people are scared to come forward. But, like, that's such a blanket term. You're scared. You're fearful. You don't really know what that means until you get the details of what someone faces. And so let's rewind to where this story kind of starts, which is September 2021. Police arrest an 18-year-old in Northeast Philadelphia, right? Mm-hmm, and he's attempting to steal a car. So, and what happens after he attempts to steal this car and gets caught?
So the car had already been stolen, and police had seen it on this block in Northeast Philly, and were kind of watching it from afar to see if they had run the license plate. They'd found that it had been stolen. They were watching it from afar to see if somebody got into the car. And this 18-year-old did. They surrounded the car. They arrested him. They brought him down to the major crimes unit, and this was the first time that this kid had ever been arrested. He'd never had a run-in with the police before. He actually no longer had lived in Philadelphia. He was only back that summer after his grandmother had passed away, and he was spending time with family. And so he was very scared. Mm. He didn't want his parents to be upset with him. He didn't know what to do, and he was panicking. And, you know, on a whim, he blurted out that he knew he had information about multiple murders for in the city,
and just blurts it out to the police.
Yeah, pretty much. My understanding is that, you know, the police didn't actually, you know, he had the nicknames of all these guys because that's how he knows them. Yeah. Right, he knows Reek and Yaw and Murder K and Curry, and so he tells the police, you know, I have this information, and the cops actually have to call another detective and say, do you know who these guys that he's talking about
people?
Are these real people? And they're like, oh my God, yeah, these are, you know, members of a gang that we've been watching for a really long time.
So that's pure luck in a sense, right? Like, mm-hmm. they just happen to arrest this kid, mm-hmm. and he just happens to say this. It's not like they're interrogating him about those murders.
That's my understanding, yes, that he, you know, came up with this information on his own to come forward about this. And, you know, I think that they, you know, once he had come forward about this, the police had to make sure that he didn't back out of the case. I wouldn't be surprised if he was interrogated and they had to make sure that he kept his word and ended up testifying in court. But in that moment, yes.
Mm. And so what evidence did this young person provide that was so critical to these cases?
So he had been in the room with many of these gang members. One of his family members was in the gang. And so when he was there that summer, he hung out with them. He wanted to fit in with them. You know, he's in the background of some of their music videos. Mm-hmm. And so when they, I mean, at one point, the guys had killed someone and came back to the house that he was staying at and openly talked about who they had killed. They openly bragged with each other about the people that they killed. And so he had overheard these firsthand conversations about what they had done.
Wow. And I want to talk about some of these murders that this group was eventually, many of them were convicted of being involved with. They shoot an 18-year-old named Nasir Marks. It's a case of mistaken identity. A 15-year-old named Kanye Pittman. A 16-year-old named KJ Johnson. And an 18-year-old named Tommy Frazier, who were not involved, you say, in the feud that precipitated all of this violence. So he says, this 18-year-old says, I know who was involved in all of these crimes because I heard the people talk about it. That's the first step, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now he has to testify. How, walk us through that process. What does it take for him to testify? what does he have to do to be in Philadelphia physically to do the testifying?
Mm-hmm. So immediately after he was released from custody on the stolen car charges, he was walking out of the courthouse with his family, and he was served with a subpoena by a homicide detective in front of his family. And so immediately people knew that he was cooperating with these crimes.
Yeah. And that was a mistake by the
detective. That was a mistake. Yeah. That detective is no longer working in homicide. Mm-hmm. So he immediately had to get out of the city. He calls his mom. He says, "Mom, this life is not for me. I want to come home." She flies him out immediately. He goes back. They now live over 1,000 miles away. So he goes back home. He's only been back to the city twice since that day, one to testify to the grand jury in one of the cases and then in the public trial for the other. And both of those times he stayed outside of the city in a hotel under a fake name. He and his mom did not even tell police where they were staying because they didn't even know if they could trust the police.
Did not even tell police.
No. Wow. And when they came to court, they had to be taken through a back entrance through the secret, you know, bottoms of the courthouse. And no one in the courtroom could leave until they were gone and being escorted by police.
I got to read in your story, you write that when the witness finally entered the courtroom, he mm-hmm. saw two relatives sitting in the spectator gallery. Not there to support him, his mother said, but on behalf of the killers. Mm-hmm. And he was crushed. Talk about what this young person had to go through mentally, emotionally, to show up and to be a critical witness in the conviction of these gunmen.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, one of his close family members was deeply involved in this group. And so his multiple relatives were there that day, not on his behalf. And people in his family were judging him. And, you know, I think when he left, his mom said that he fell into a deep depression when he got back home. He wasn't leaving home or he wasn't leaving his bed. He felt like he had failed people in his family. And he can never come back here. You know, if someone close in his family died tomorrow, he wouldn't be able to come to their funeral because he is still at such risk. I think that he felt a lot of guilt for that. And it's a really complicated thing for a young person to go through. And when, you know, your cousins or your friends all, you know, are all ingrained in this and you can never see and talk to them again. And they're talking about you in songs and they're talking about you on the internet. He went through a lot.
But on the flip side, what has been the reaction of the families of KJ Johnson, mm-hmm. Tommy Frazier, Nasir Marx, Kanye Pittman, others, to finally getting justice? And this is something that doesn't happen normally in many cases of homicide in Philadelphia.
They were just so grateful. And they actually didn't really know a lot of the backstory either. And so I would, you know, I called them before the story came out. And I was in talks with them as I was reporting. And, you know, Cage's mom started to cry when I told her about it. And she said, "I love this kid with every ounce of love that I have left, and I thank him, and KJ loves him." And Kanye Pittman's mom says that he was a hero to her in that moment, because they know how hard all of this is. They've seen this their entire lives, why so many people never come forward. And so for a teenager to do it, they knew it was really quite remarkable.
Yeah, you quote a detective in this piece who says, "I've never seen a young kid do that, what this witness did. Never." I mean, that's a striking term, because this detective, I assume, has investigated many, many, many cases. Mm-hmm. So that does leave you feeling a little bit hopeless, because you think, well, this happened once in this detective's career. How repeatable is it? I mean, what does this story tell you about projecting forward what can be done to solve murder cases, especially with these repeat offenders?
Mm-hmm. The DA's office has a gun violence task force that has really been looking at these groups. And so, you know, police and prosecutors have found other ways. You know, they know how hard it is to find witnesses and to convince them to talk at trial. And so now they're really relying on forensics. They're relying on phones, cell phone data that is, you know, towers that are putting people at the scene. You know, the reality is that a lot of the kids, you know, the young people involved in this violence are talking about it very publicly. They're singing about it. They're writing about it on their Instagram. They're posting about it in their stories within minutes of the shooting. And so in some ways, they're sometimes
because
telling on themselves.
That's the reason why they're doing it. I mean, you mentioned mm-hmm. in the piece, right, that some of these murders are done for clout. They're done for attention.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's a good thing for the police in some sense, because it means that they're going to tell on themselves.
Mm-hmm. But I also think it shows still how important a witness is in a case. And, you know, even though they had forensic evidence and they had video of the cars and they had, you know, they had the guys talking about it in the songs, that's not always enough. You still need someone who's going to, you know, convince the jury that,
Push them past reasonable doubt.
Exactly. Yeah. And provide the context to the killing. And especially in this case, you know, it was essential to the case.
I have to ask you, as we get ready to wrap up this segment, this is such a fascinating discussion, but I want you to talk about why you felt this it was so important to tell this story, because the young man was reluctant to talk to you. He has been going through so much anguish. Why did you personally feel like this was a story that had to be told? Mm-hmm.
We've been following this story, many of these murders, from the day that they'd happened. And it's really just now, like, you know, in the last few months that finally we've been able to kind of connect the dots on a lot of these shootings. And so, you know, I think that we don't often see the behind the scenes of what leads to a shooting. How many of these shootings are really connected, especially in West Philly around the times of 2020 and 2021. You know, people on social media and Instagram are talking about this kid. They're still singing about him. And I think that it's important for people to see the behind the scenes of what he went through, why he put himself at such risk. And also, you know, some of the bureaucracy that went into it. His mom had to pay for almost everything to get him here and do this.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Witnesses need a lot of need more protection. They need more resources. People need to, you know, help getting out of the city if they're going to cooperate with police and prosecutors on these cases.
And I think so many of us have this sort of blanket question. Why can't they solve these cases? Well, read this story and you can see how difficult it is and how much courage it takes from one person to sort of make all the dominoes fall. It's a great story. Ellie Rushing, reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great reporting. Coming up, we're talking about what it takes to become vegan.
Okay.
And veganism.
Sure.
Let's talk about it. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry, I've talked about this. I gave up meat last year.
Congratulations.
Interesting. I didn't think of that as something congratulatory.
It's good.
Okay, I'll puff my chest out a little bit. I'm not a vegan, though.
Mm-hmm.
I've not tiptoed over that line yet. However, I will say that it does seem easier to achieve than maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. It feels within reach.
Yeah, absolutely. I see it everywhere now, whether that's at the supermarket or on menus at restaurants. You know, the little V with the leaf that indicates no animal products. One restaurant here in Philadelphia went vegan well before this new trend. Miss Rachel's Pantry has been around since 2012. And with us today is the founder, Rachel Klein. Rachel, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
It's so great that you're here and you bought some food too, which is even better. But there's a lot to discuss also beyond taste, about the environmental and nutritional aspects of veganism or plant-based eating. So here to help us with all of that is Marissa Cloutier, an assistant professor of nutrition and public health instruction at Temple. Marissa, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey. Actually, associate professor.
Associate professor.
All right, just got promoted. So
all right, congratulations.
All right,
Marissa.
As of yesterday.
And before we get going, vegans and vegan curious folks, if you want to chime in, why did you go vegan? If you're not, what's your hesitation? Would you consider veganism? Why or why not? The lines are open. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
We should probably start with definitions here because, you know, people can define veganism their own way. So, Rachel, what does it mean to you? Like, what's allowed, what's not allowed?
Yeah, so I don't see animals as commodities. So as a vegan person, I don't eat meat, dairy, eggs, fish, any animal byproduct. And I don't wear leather or wool. So that is kind of holistic for me.
So honey, too?
Honey, too, yeah.
What are some of the other ones? Gelatin, no gelatin.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so innocuous, right? Like, oh, it's just like Jell-O, but it comes from bones.
Yep.
So it's not for me.
Wonderful. And so I want to, I know, and I want to hear more. So I want to find out, Marissa, why some people sort of make the transition. What are some of the arguments people make besides just nutrition?
Oh, yes. Where do I begin? it's interesting to use the word commodity because it is a big business. The using animals for products, you know, food and elsewhere, as you were mentioning. The way we do meat nowadays is an ecological and public health disaster. I can get into the nitty-gritty if you want to, but a lot of people are seeing that, and they're starting to not want to opt into that kind of a system and into a system that's more ecological and public-friendly and conducive to public health.
Was that what convinced you, Rachel, to become a vegan? Like, when did you become a vegan, and was it an ecological argument? Was it a moral ethical argument?
I think for me, it was a moral ethical argument. When I was in kindergarten, I said I wouldn't eat anything with a face, and so I was vegetarian from that point until 2008. And then, you know, there's a lot of shock tactics that are used to be like, oh, like this is what the inside of a slaughterhouse looks like. And for me, that just turned me off. I didn't want to see. But to hear some personal stories from people working on a farm and seeing like, okay, when you're eating dairy, and where do the baby boy cows go? They get taken from their mother within a day. And that kind of pulled at my heartstrings. And I was like, I don't want to participate in this anymore. And it's really easy, especially now, not to.
Let's talk about that,
yeah.
The fact that it's really easy. Here's an email from Buck, because it wasn't so easy for Buck. Buck says, I tried veganism for 17 months. I felt great after the initial period of incredible flatulence. With simple substitutions, you can easily find things to make that can convert many of your favorite things to a vegan option. The thing that I missed most, though, was cheese. Vegan cheese just doesn't Ooh. Cut it and doesn't melt or taste like the real deal. All right, so I'll direct this to Rachel first.
Yeah.
What types of substitutes do you use a lot? What are your kind of your go-tos in your pantry?
Yeah.
What substitutes have gotten better and what maybe still fall a little short?
Yeah, I was really holding back a cutting the cheese joke.
Buck teed it up for you there.
Thank you, Buck. I think that cheese is a really big one. Cheese is like a drug, not
yeah.
to be like a weirdo, but we make a lot of our own cheeses, so what we do is kind of higher end, but it's incredible. I remember blogging back in 2008, 2009 and getting samples in the mail of like just god awful like rubbery plastic stuff, but there's a lot of good stuff on the market these days. I think that vegan people are, and people who don't eat dairy, because that's also some of our customers, and we get regular people too. But I think that there's been leaps and bounds these days where we're not settling for things that don't taste good and that don't melt when they're supposed to. You know, they have to melt, they have to taste good, they have to satisfy that richness. We make a lot of our own cheeses with cashews as our base. We do a lot of culturing, so you get that tang in there, you get a little bit of that funk. We are just really passionate about making something that tastes good, because if it's especially somebody's first vegan cheese experience, you can't mess that up, because then they won't eat it again.
That is very true. I want to read this comment from Kate, who says, I've been vegan for 40 years. It helped me recover from a bad accident. I credit it with how I feel now. I'm 80 years old, but I feel like I am 30.
Oh, that's a
convincing
argument. Kate,
I need to, whatever you eat, Kate, I probably need to eat it too. I will tell you, I want to ask you this, Rachel, because, not Rachel, Marissa, sorry about that. So many people have said they didn't want to go vegan because of protein. You know, I need protein, and they think the only way you can get protein is from meat. But this has been a myth that has been sort of carried out throughout to stop people from making the crossover. Can you tell us the actual truth here?
Yeah, huge myth. There is no protein emergency on any level if you have access to food. Our body, we have evolved to hold on to protein very efficiently. Whatever little bit we get, we're going to hold on to. This notion that we are all protein deprived is really pushed by those that they have benefit to gain, I guess you could say, by pushing some of these really wacky diets, these high protein diets. So you could definitely, back in the day when I was being trained, we used to talk about complementary proteins, where you had to take a grain and a nut. You know, a classic peanut butter and jelly sandwich was that for a reason, was to deliver complete amino acids to our kids, but at the same meal. But now you don't have to eat at the same meal a grain and a nut, just say these plant-based proteins. As long as you eat them within the span of a day, you know, you can have nibble on some nuts in the morning, you know, have your whole grain, brown rice, whatever, in the night, you're going to get your complement. You're going to get all your amino acids you need to support health.
Yeah, that kind of makes me think, what are some of the traps people might fall into nutritionally if they just convert to be a plant-based diet without really thinking about it? They just go, well, I'll just only eat the plant-based stuff that I know. Like, what are some of the nutritional traps you can fall into if you don't do this intentionally?
Well, I think the biggest thing with vegan diets, with any diet, is stay away from the highly processed foods and just go whole foods. You cannot miss. And, you know, certainly visiting restaurants like, you know, yours, Rachel, and seeing how food is put together, certainly there's numerous now access to any kind of recipes, blogs all over the place, you know, on the social media, websites. It's not hard at all. Again, if you're eating, the good old peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you're eating vegan, you know. To say you're vegan doesn't have to be this mysterious thing of probably a lot of what you're already eating. You know, your oatmeal in the morning with some, you know, mix it in. You know, going back to the nuts, I'm a nut fanatic.
You're nuts for
but
nuts.
Yeah. But, you know, your oatmeal in the morning, hey, you're vegan. You know, you didn't even know it, right? So it's not a heavy lift to eat plant-based foods. And but certainly you want to, you know, certainly, if you have questions about nutrition, certainly consult with a dietitian, nutritionist. Certainly, you know, call over to Temple University. We love to talk to you as nutrition professors. You know, it's not hard to find information on how to do veganism correctly.
But you said no highly processed stuff. Some of these substitutes, like the fake meat, is that stuff highly processed?
Yeah, I would just anything ultra processed across the board, avoid. They're just, you do not want, we do not have the data available to understand what these wacky processing ingredients do to the body. They, you know, pretty relatively new on the evolutionary time scale to really measure that. But anything ultra processed, stay away from, no matter what diet you follow. So anything that's been doesn't look like the real food, you know, that you look at the ingredients list, it has a whole plethora of ingredients you can't identify. You know, avoid on all costs is what I'd always recommend. And it's a lot cheaper to stay, you know, eating from the whole thing too. If you process food, can really add up. And then there's the whole ecological, you know, all the plastics involved with that too, that you want to avoid as well.
I want to read this email from Jess, who says, I have started moving toward veganism a few months ago, but haven't fully committed. What's holding me back is the fact that growing up in a large family, I learned a lot of quick, easy meals that I could rely on as an adult that I can make and shop for without thinking. I don't have the same mental library of meal ideas to fall back on, and I struggle to think of new things I can make that are vegan. I end up making the same few vegan recipes all the time. So, Rachel.
Yes.
Help.
We
help
need some staples.
Yes. Give us some basics.
We need some staples.
So I'm a carnivore, full disclosure.
I see
if
the
I'm
teeth.
Trying, you see them, they kind of pointy, tearing through all that meaty flesh. Yeah. But if I decided, you know what, maybe I just want to make one or two meals, you know, a day that don't have meat.
Yeah.
What are some basic things I can put in my pantry to get started?
Yeah. So I think I want to start by saying a lot of the times we think like whole grains, you know, lentils, things like that. It sounds not that appetizing. It doesn't sound very good, but I would say start with the sauces you already like. You know, if you like a cream sauce, there's an alternative for you. If you like a barbecue sauce, there's an alternative for you. And you can use sauces, spices, and different flavors to keep familiar things in your body. Like if you grew up eating, I don't know, sesame chicken, maybe you'll like sesame seitan, right? To keep it familiar. But what I like to do is to just, you know, you really like chickpeas. I like chickpeas. I'm saying you guys love it.
I like chickpeas.
You chop up those chickpeas. You can fold in some mustard, mayo. We make vegan mayo now. Isn't that exciting? Celery, carrot, celery seed, salt and pepper. You've got a chickpea salad that's like tuna salad, and you can keep that in your fridge throughout the week. Put it on your sandwiches. You're great. You want to make a fancy ricotta? take some tofu, olive oil, salt, pepper, a little bit of garlic, blend that in the food processor, put it on a plate, pile a nice tomato salad on there. Mm. You know, so it doesn't have to be weird, and it can be elegant, but it can also be so simple. You can make peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yeah.
I always make a lentil curry every
lentil
week.
Lentil curry.
You know, just...
That does sound very
curry.
Good.
You know,
yeah.
And it's...
Just throwing curry
just,
on there. I'm
just
like,
put some nice flavor, get some spice. It doesn't have to be boring. It can be very exciting. I mean, I'm still alive, and I'm good, and also I have a livelihood.
I can testify to that.
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm not like puppeted, and I have a business, which is also my livelihood. So my whole life is eating and serving people this way. So it's good, and people want it, and I'm good. I'm still upright. So.
Yeah. Yeah, you look very healthy.
Okay.
Marissa, you want to jump in there?
If I can just chime in. When in doubt, go talk to grandma, right? So the traditional cultural cuisines around the world celebrate plant foods.
Yeah.
And just go back and just going, you know, look at your culture and what were these dishes that are celebrated through millennial. You know, they're plant-based, a lot of them. And so I just wanted to...
Yeah, that's a great point. A lot of traditional foods already fit in this box. Let's read some emails here because we have a bunch of them. Rebecca says, I was a vegan for about 7 years, felt amazing. But my one rule was that if I was at someone's house and they were cooking for me, I would eat whatever they put out, regardless of whether it was vegan or not, because preserving a relationship and appreciating the kindness of others was more important to me than being strict with my diet.
Interesting.
That's Rebecca's perspective.
Yeah.
Now I want to read another email from Amy, and we have a few emails in the same vein. Amy says, I'm curious how you feel about the connection people make between veganism and various cultural ideas like emasculation, anti-Americanism. You know what I mean, the quote, real men eat meat, bacon, or you're not American. That's Amy's question and email. Marissa, what do you say to that? Because there is a cultural connection between the term veganism and certain ideas about who a vegan is.
Yeah, unfortunately, the culture wars have, you know, crept into all aspects of our life. And it's interesting you say that. I, you know, even like doing the going to try to do the lab raised beef, if you will, or the, you know, made DeSantis, the governor of Florida, banned. You can't make, you know, meat in a lab. It has to come from the real thing. Again, it's a culture war thing. There's only so much you can put into the body before the body gives out. And typically individuals, when they reach that first heart attack, that first major heart attack, or that first diagnosis of pre-diabetes, diabetes, that's when it starts to, you know, reality hits that, you know, this what's been told to us with this machoism, you know, is, you know, you really, reality hits when you're in the hospital, right? So I think, you know, just to press forward, we've come a long way of acceptance of all aspects of our humanity. We have more to do, but certainly, you know, that still exists. But again, just pressing that this notion of health, you know, that you want longevity, you know, you really want to go more of a plant-based. And certainly, again, what your viewer just said, you know, certainly you don't have to go, you know, extremes here. You know, you're following a primarily plant-based diet for the majority of time, but you are going to hit those times where you're going to have to eat that piece of chicken, right? You're at a party, you're at a wedding. You don't have to do, you know, for health, you don't have to go extreme. So maybe these individuals that are worried about their image, when they're out, eat the burger, right? When they're out with the boys, eat your burger. But when you come home, you know, really try to focus on eating more plant-based.
Mm. Yeah, I want to read this email from Casimir, who says, I was raised vegetarian from birth and just went vegan 3 weeks ago. The
Whoa,
same morals.
3 weeks ago.
Congratulations, Casimir. And Casimir says, the same morals that kept me vegetarian pushed me to be vegan, but a big part for me was also economic and environmental reasons. And so, Rachel, you've made the transition.
I've been there. Yeah.
What have people said, the folks you've been feeding these folks who've transitioned over to veganism? What have you heard? Give us the kind of closing argument for folks making the transition.
Well, I don't think that you have to be vegan to eat vegan food. Mm. And I think that we are human beings. We do live in a society. I think that if your friends are vegan or vegetarian, To the previous caller's point, it's important to respect your friend's wishes. If your friends are vegan and you're having them at your wedding, feed them vegan food. That's not nice. You know, but we do learn from each other. We pull from each other's cultures. We eat food from all different communities. Try something new. Incorporate vegan food into your diet. You don't have to be vegan to enjoy a nice vegan meal.
Yeah. Sometimes it starts with one step, right?
Yep.
And one meal. I think I can wrap in more vegan
chickpeas. All right. Well, yes. We have to end the conversation, even though we have many more comments we could not get to today. But thank you, Rachel Klein, founder of the vegan restaurant Ms. Rachel's Pantry.
Thank you.
And Marissa Cloutier, associate professor. Congratulations on nutrition and public health instruction at Temple. Marissa, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Studio 2. Our show was produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you next week.